From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A historic meeting between the two Koreas will take place on Friday, April 27th, with South Korea's Moon Jae-in and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. The summit will be held in the heavily secure border village of Panmunjom within the demilitarized zone. The meeting between the two Korean leaders could lead to a formalizing of peace decades after an armistice agreement was signed in 1953. The Korean summit is expected to be a precursor to another historic potential meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and the North Korean leader that Trump has repeatedly belittled on Twitter. Shocking many earlier this week, Trump said in joint remarks with French President Emmanuel Macron that Kim Jong-un was, quote, honorable. My guest is Christine Ahn, founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Welcome to the program, Christine.
Hi, Sonali.
So before we get into what is expected to happen on Friday between the representatives of the two Koreas and the two leaders, I'm wondering what your comments are on what Donald Trump said during joint remarks with the French president earlier this week, where he called Kim Jong-un honorable. A lot of people have glommed onto that. A lot of people are very upset about it. The Washington Post said this is the president being played by the North Korean leader. And of course, Trump has called Kim Jong-un little rocket man multiple times in the past. So this is an about turn. What are your thoughts on this use of the word honorable to describe Kim Jong-un?
Well, I'd say that Donald Trump has used words rather flagrantly, and I don't think it's with so much intention, but I think the gesture behind that is to reciprocate the kind of warm diplomatic feelings and messages that have come from North Korea with concrete policy shifts ahead of the joint summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. So I wouldn't take it as more than that. I think it's, for me, certainly a welcome gesture than threats of total annihilation or calling another sovereign country's leader little rocket man. So, you know, I've been quite surprised by the way the liberal media and even groups such as Human Rights Watch to condemn Donald Trump for engaging in diplomatic discourse with North Korea that, you know, really could be an important stepping stone towards improving the human rights conditions of North Korean people.
Right. I mean, I suppose honorable is better than little rocket man, but our president is not really known for being diplomatic. So it seems as though there's either this, you know, effusive love or stark hatred and nothing in between. So if we have to pick, love is better than hate. Explain what exactly is expected to happen on Friday, April 27th, in the border village within the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas. How historic is this meeting?
It's historic. I mean, Kim Jong-un is the first North Korean leader to basically cross the DMZ and to have a meeting with a standing South Korean president. We have seen two historic summits between the leaders of North and South Korea. We saw one in 2007 between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea. And then we saw a subsequent one in 2007 between Noh Moo-hyun, who, you know, Moon Jae-in, the current South Korean president, was the chief of staff for that administration, with Kim Jong-il, the father of Kim Jong-un. And now we have Kim Jong-un, the third generation of the Kim family, meeting with Moon Jae-in. And, you know, basically they have three things on their agenda. The first is obviously to talk about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The second is, you know, basically putting aside historic enmity between the two countries, which have prevailed for 70 years, to establish some kind of peace regime. And the third is, you know, concrete steps towards improving inter-Korean relations. And we've already seen progress towards that end. We saw, you know, obviously a joint military hotline established, a direct line between, Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in. We've seen, obviously the two Koreas marching together under one Korea flag in the Olympics, and athletes competing together and on a joint women's hockey team. And then we just saw recently a really high profile stars of the South Korean music and artist community going to North Korea for a big performance in Pyongyang. So, I think Moon Jae-in, he sees he has four more years to really bring an end to this conflict. And it feels that the stars are aligned to really achieve that.
Right. Many are crediting him for this current moment of potential warming of relations, both between the two Koreas and between the U.S. and North Korea. Now, in 1953, there was an armistice agreement that was signed, leading to as much peace as a sort of a stopping of hostilities between the two Koreas. Some are hoping that the summit that will take place on Friday may lead to a formalizing of that and an actual peace treaty between the two. Is it too optimistic to hope for that?
Well, it's going to be the only thing that's going to actually lead to a true denuclearization of North Korea. I mean, North Korea has said they are not willing to give up their nuclear weapons unless they have basically security assurances in the form of a peace treaty. And so we really have to be pushing for this. And it's great that South Korea has said this. And it's great that Donald Trump has come forward to say, I mean, he's finally said what no American president has said, is that the Korean War has never ended. But I would say that the framing is a little bit off, because really the signatories of that armistice agreement was North Korea, China, and the United States, on behalf of the UN command. And so as much as South Korea would like to see there to be a peace treaty, it really is incumbent upon the United States to be a signatory to that agreement.
What is China's interest currently in this moment? China is, I understand, in part concerned about North Korea's nuclear capabilities, but what else is at stake?
Well, what's at stake is a unified Korean peninsula, or a Korea with the U.S. presence still on the Korean peninsula. And so I think China has been, shifting its tune on North Korea, because they've seen this shift, obviously, with the U.S. And I would say that what is not so much disclosed, and that is very much underlying this dramatic shift, is a major report that the U.S. came out with, that the Pentagon came out with in December, that basically says that it's ridiculous, it's not new, but it's basically a new Cold War. They have outlined that ISIS is no longer, the preeminent threat to U.S. security, national security, but in fact, it's China and Russia. And so, that is, I think, the larger issue at play. And for the Korean Peninsula, because of its geostrategic location, is the unfortunate victim of always being the target of superpowers invaded, historically by China, Japan, Russia, and obviously an ongoing U.S. military occupation in South Korea. So, I think a lot of it is geopolitics at play. The U.S. trying to secure its foothold, literally, still on the Korean Peninsula, and recognizing that it probably went too far with its maximum pressure campaign. Because if we recall the last time that North Korea conducted a missile test, we saw Moon Jae-in quickly condemn North Korea for its missile and nuclear tests. But we also saw Moon Jae-in send a clear message to Washington, D.C., and said, there will not be a conflict on the Korean Peninsula without South Korean agreement. And so I think that was quite a game-changing moment. And it really, I think, set forth the process between the two Koreas to say, we have to come together for Korea, and to advance Korean interests and not be beholden to foreign powers.
Is it fair to say that peace between the two Koreas would negate U.S. presence there altogether, that suddenly the U.S. would be left with no real reason to remain there?
Well, there is, again, the geopolitical struggle, right? And so I think that's part of why there is this rapprochement between the U.S. and North Korea. North Korea has signaled already in its preparations for its summits with the U.S. To South Korea that they are not opposed to the 30,000 U.S. troops remaining in South Korea. In past agreements, they have noted that they are not demanding the withdrawal. And, you know, in some ways, they see it as a balance of power. Now, you know, we'll see. I mean, that's clearly not the sentiment for a lot of the peace movement in South Korea that sees the ongoing militarization, the ongoing maintenance of 30,000 U.S. troops, the construction of the naval base on Jeju Island in Gangjeong, or the THAAD missile defense system that is being deployed in Songju, and how that, you know, continues to make Korea very vulnerable to a potential being the site of a war between the U.S. and China.
What needs to happen on Friday that is expected to lay the groundwork for the other historic meeting between Trump himself and Kim Jong-un that has been talked about? Not quite clear if it will happen yet, but does that meeting depend on how the Friday meeting transpires?
Well, I would say that, you know, the train is moving. I mean, North and South Korea see the long-term benefits for their economic, political, military benefit to having peace on the Korean Peninsula. And I think that with that progress moving forward, with North and South Korea and there being a peace process on the Korean Peninsula really negates any opportunity for the U.S. to conduct a preemptive strike on North Korea. And so I think it would basically take war off the table. But we have seen in the past, you know, especially in the Sunshine era, you know, from the late 1990s through 2007, a decade of warming between inter-Korean relations, that that progress towards peace and reconciliation on the Korean Peninsula only goes so far as long as that hostilities remain between the U.S. and North Korea. And so we have to remember that the Korean War and ending the Korean War isn't just about ending a civil war between North and South Korea, but that it's ending a global conflict. We can't forget that over 20 nations participated in the Korean War, that it was led on the UN command side by the US forces in Korea, but included soldiers from Canada, from the UK, from France, from Netherlands. You know, it was a global conflict. And as such, there is an international responsibility to help bring closure to it.
The summit on Friday is being prepared very carefully. It's happening, as I mentioned, at this very, you know, strongly fortified village that lies on the border in the demilitarized zone. There's news reports about the kind of food that's going to be served and exactly who will be in attendance. Is there, at the risk of sounding pessimistic, is there anything that could go wrong at the last minute? We're talking about, you know, at least one of the two leaders in attendance. Unfortunately, Kim Jong-un is somebody like Trump, someone who can be impulsive.
Well, I would say that what we have seen is a lot of South Korean officials that have already gone and who have met Kim Jong-un actually come back with a very different perception about Kim Jong-un, that he's actually quite quite sophisticated, he's quite savvy, that he is, that, you know, that they've basically disabused this myth that he is erratic. I think, you know, that has been part of the way that the US media has liked to portray North Korea. But we even know that the CIA have said that North Korea and the North Korean leader is very calculated. He is very, very intentional. And I would, you know, come back to the point that while Moon Jae-in and his masterful diplomacy, and thank goodness for the Candlelight Revolution that brought Moon Jae-in into power and ended, aborted the presidency of Park Geun-hye that had a very hard line, pro-war kind of stance against North Korea, that, North Korea has always had this in their plan. I mean, if we look at their five-year plan from 2016 through 2020, they have included that, you know, they would come to some kind of closure on its nuclear and missile testing, that they would, you know, seek to advance improved relations with South Korea with the changing of the administration, that they would seek to have, you know, improved diplomatic relations with the U.S. So I'm not saying that, this has always been part of North Korea's plan, but in some ways, this has been. We know that they have a Pyongjin policy, which is advancing its nuclear policy as a deterrent, but also improving the economic well-being of its country. And we've seen changes on the policy level from North Korea. And, you know, I think they really see improved relations with South Korea and also with the U.S. as critical to improving the development of their economy and society.
Now, I'm also wondering if you see the example that Moon Jae-in has given as something that really needs to be touted as a significant model, because sometimes all it takes is a leader who is committed enough to want to build bridges rather than drop bombs. And honestly, even a small number of changes in leadership through democratic electoral processes, of course, can have a huge impact on wars, on safety and security of people.
Absolutely. And, Kim Dae-jung, who was really the forefront of the Sunshine Policy coming from South Korea, on his deathbed, he told Moon Jae-in, you know, you have to carry on this legacy. And I think Moon Jae-in not only has come from the pro-democracy movement, he was himself a human rights lawyer, but he personally experiences Korean division through his family. I mean, his mother came from the North. His mother was one of the very privileged few from South that was able to meet her sister in North Korea during the years of inter-Korean reconciliation, where they committed to family reunion. So I think he has a personal impact and a personal stake to see through the advancement of reconciliation and the final closure of the 70-year war. And as much as I detest Donald Trump and virtually everything he's doing on every front, it is taking the political will of him. And whether it's for his own narcissistic reason, whether it's because it's helping to improve his polls in the United States, this is taking political courage. And I am in gratitude to Donald Trump for doing that. And he's doing something that no president was willing to do. And whether or not the Obama administration had an entirely well-staffed diplomatic corps, they didn't have the political will to do it. And I know that we are under extremely different circumstances. There is a vastly different president in South Korea. That is, as you pointed out, the result of a democratic movement that swept him into power. If you look at surveys today, 80% of South Koreans want there to be a peace agreement with North Korea. He is reflecting the will and the mandate of the people, and he has overwhelming support for this agenda.
Well, Christine, we're going to have you back on our program on Monday to follow up on how the summit we're talking about actually went, the historic summit between the two Korean leaders happening Friday, April 27th. And we'll be back with my guest, Christine, on next week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
Christine Ahn is a founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. We've been discussing this Friday's Korea Summit. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.